Ukraine calling.
What is the root cause of war? Now, that's a huge question. Is it that some lives are more valuable than others?
You can imagine what Russia will say in dozens of years. And we have to have this solid evidence that it happened. If we want to prevent wars in the future, we have to punish the state and the leaders who start such wars in present. We are fighting for something which are not limited by national borders. Freedom, justice, human dignity, the value of human life. Even when we succeed for justice for Ukrainians, it will be precedent for justice to other people in different parts of the globe who are suffering in this moment from wars and human rights. Well, imagine even this fantastic scenario that tomorrow we will return all Ukrainian territories.
That would be sweet.
But it doesn't mean that the day after tomorrow, Russia will not start the war again. The big war is still coming.
So this is maybe the medium war. Hello, everybody. This is Brian Bonner, host of Ukraine Calling on Hromadske Radio. Just when you think that Russia can't get any lower, horrible events proved otherwise. Bombing the largest children's hospital in Ukraine, bombing a maternity hospital, and bombing a kindergarten were among the targets of the Russian mass bombing on Monday. I have just the guest in the studio to show us the way out of it, hopefully, to give us some clues about how to stop this carnage. And so I welcome Alexander Matvichuk.
Thank you for the invitation.
I am so honored to meet you. Out of the 14 years I was leading the Kyiv Post, we had never met, so this is our first chance to talk. But Alexander, of course, is one of the great human rights champions of Ukraine. She is a Nobel Peace Prize winner with this Center for Civil Liberties that she heads, along with Memorial in Russia and Belarus. She has made invisible human rights visible to the world. She, no matter how many cases we have more than 100,000 cases of human rights abuse, war crimes. She manages to personalize the stories, as she puts it, give the names to the victims. And she also thinks beyond just documenting, which is very important and kind of thankless and difficult work, but also how to restructure the international architecture of the world to prevent wars and to punish those who are guilty of war crimes. And so, you know, with that, I'm curious as how you assessed this week. Out of all the horrible tragedies, I keep waiting for this time where the world says, okay, this is enough. We're going to stop this guy. We're going to give Ukraine everything it needs to win, and we're going to give it to them now, and we're going to get this guy on, you know, war crimes. Have we reached that point yet?
It's a good question. Because all this hell which we now face this week in Kyiv, Kryvyi Rih, Dnipro, and other cities, which were massively bombarded by Russian rockets, it's a result of total impunity which Russia enjoyed for decades. Because Russia hit hospitals in Chechnya, Russia hit hospitals in Georgia, Russia hit hospitals in Syria, Russia hit hospitals in Ukraine, and Russia have never been punished for this. So without punishment, we can expect it, unfortunately, that the situation will continue, and not just in Ukraine, not to be very naive to think that Ukraine will be the last stop of Russian empire. That's why it's so important to find a way how to reconstruct this long-lasting tradition of impunity which Russia enjoyed for decades.
I know you're a lawyer who says that the international legal system is broken. I think many people agree with you there. But let's just say there was a conference, all the world's powers, Russia, the United States, agreed that we would create a enforceable, binding security architecture to prevent wars and to prevent genocides and to prevent killing. What would that look like in your view? And you were appointed one of the co-chairs to devise that system.
Let me formulate it like this. Someone who can find the answers to the questions how to build this new international architecture in a proper way will definitely receive a Nobel Peace Prize. because we have to answer at least for two questions. The first question is how to make people voice from different countries to be heard in this platform, because a lot of states who now members of United Nations for current moment, they are not represent their people. They represent current ruling elite or dictators or some kleptocrats, but not people voice. And this is a question, how to construct this architecture in a way that people will be heard, not just as regimes who captured power in their country. And second question, how to design this international architecture to make it based on the human rights, not on GDP, not on the size of the country, what we observe for current moment in Security Council, and even in this discussion, how to reform Security Council to include, for example, India, Brazil, and other big countries with a large GDP, but on human rights and values. This is a second question which need answer.
What is the root cause of war? Now, that's a huge question. Is it that some lives are more valuable than others? Is it greed? Is it macho? Is it male superiority and the lack of women's rights? Is it, what is it? Have you, I know you've thought about this.
I think everything which you mentioned, because it's always a complex. But also, I am confident that it's a nature of empire and it's nature of an autocracy regime. Because empire has a center but has no borders. And if empire has energy, empire always try to expand. It's a way how to survive in empire, for empire 21st century. And even if it's not empire, just autocracy regime, only existence of free world always provide the threats for dictators to lose their power. That's why they will always attack. They can't coexist with a free world.
I look at that person in the Kremlin, and I just see greed, insecurity, this idea that some people are more valuable than others and that human life is worthless, pretty much. When you're firing 44 missiles into Ukraine, you pretty much don't care who you kill. You know, Nazi Germany, when defeated and Imperial Japan defeated, they did, there was consequences and they did reorganize their societies along democratic lines. Now they're one of our greatest allies. When you go to the post-World War II architecture, which is broken now, that, as you've pointed out, never happened under Stalin, Holodomor, any of this human rights abuses, gulags, anything. So there was one step, and the Allies, frankly, just wanted to go home and have peace and go back to their lives. Russia, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and I know that's where you get your start in human rights, was on its back for a while, but it didn't take Putin very long to get off his back and use Chechnya, as you mentioned, as the first stop. Was there a point in time where you think he could have been stopped before what happened here?
Sure. I think the Chechnya was an alarming point, because what Russians did in Chechnya, it's not just beyond the norms of international humanitarian law, it's beyond the norms of humanity. They first experienced the practice of filtration camp there. They destroyed to the scratch the city of 500,000 people, I mean Grozny in Chechnya. And the world keep the blind eye on what Russia did to
because
Chechnya.
Because Chechens weren't valuable people.
Because of different reasons. Because, let's be honest, well-developed democracies need cheap oil and gas.
Yes.
And in order to have the sources of cheap oil and gas, they try to keep balanced relations with Putin and Kremlin's elite. And this once again show us a very simple historical lessons learned. When you based your political decision only on economic benefits, your political career, geopolitical interests, or illusion of security, even if you benefit in short time, you will await for catastrophe in long time. The problem is not just you, but all of us.
Yeah, I think in the West, it was the attitude was, well, Chechnya is far away, and anyway, radical Muslims and nothing we can do. And yeah, we like cheap oil and gas, and let's hope Russia democratizes. So then Syria next. And for a while, it looked like we were going to stop. You know, there was going to be a Western coalition to stop. That went away completely. And now nobody thinks about Syria, or nobody really cares about Syrians.
No, it's a very sad for me personally, because when I hear about this double standard and different treatment of different conflicts, the first what came to my mind is Syria. And then I remember this, my personal story, two stories which I want to share. First, I was one of co-organizer of public protest near Russian embassy when Russia bombarded Aleppo. Mm-hmm. And we organized this public protest with demand to push Russia to open green corridors and at least to save civilians from the city. And I remember that we gathered probably dozens of civil activists in Ukraine, but it wasn't thousands. And I always remind this example to Ukrainian people, because now we ask from others something which we are not demonstrated by ourselves. Because for us, probably Syria was also far from away. Right. And people don't go to bed with thoughts of Syria, and with thoughts of Syria don't get up. And now when Ukrainians demand from different countries to do something the same, we have to be honest that we're also responsible. Yes. But second story is a story of the right behavior. When large-scale war started, I got a letter from my human rights colleagues from Syria. Mm-hmm. It was a very human letter. They wrote me that we are with you in solidarity. We know what the war is about. We know what human pain is about. And please tell us what we can do to help you. Mm-hmm. We'll do everything which we can, because your fight, it's our fight. And this is a good example how to tackle with these double standards, not to compete with each other for attention, but unite efforts.
There was another missed opportunity. And then we all lived through 2014 revolution, which Vladimir Putin decided to retaliate by invading and taking Crimea. And, you know, we were here from 2014 to 2022, started the little war before the big war started. Well, first of all, did you see the big war coming? I lived here during those 8 years, and I have my answer, but I would like to hear yours.
I'm afraid that the big war is still coming.
So this is maybe the medium war.
I don't know how historians in future will call this period, but it's very turbulent time. Yeah. Because this impunity encourage other authoritarian leaders in the world to do the same. Because they observe that your human rights guarantees, your security means nothing. You can't rely on international system of peace and security. It's very weak. So it's very easy to predict that they will start to challenge this system to get more benefits and to change the world order, which is based on rules and UN charter, for something else, which will be based on force.
So this was the medium war, but did you, from 2014 to 2022, did you, before this happened, did you, and you documented a lot of human rights abuses during this period of time. And the scale was, you know, mercifully, it was horrible, but the scale was mercifully smaller than the scale of human rights abuses now, correct?
Yes and no.
Yes and no.
Because when we speak about big war, I always remind myself that for people in Crimea, for people in Luhansk, yes, and Donetsk regions, 2014 was a big war, because this was a moment when everything which they call normal life was ruined completely. So for them, there is no difference, small war or big war, because they were on a hot spot.
They lost their world, yes. We both know many, you know many more, but yes, we know that. But did you think, okay, they're going to come to Kyiv, or did you think that maybe they would be satisfied with what they had?
Let me explain my feeling like this. When Revolution of Dignity started, I created the civil initiative Euromaidan SOS. And we brought up several thousands of people to provide legal and other assistance to persecuted protesters. We worked 24 hours per day to provide legal aid, and hundreds and hundreds of people every day passed through our care, people who were beaten, arrested, tortured, fabricated in criminal cases. And later in February 2014, relatives of killed people. And I remember in Dynamic how I told to myself, so what the hell is going on? It can't be worse. And then it became more and more worse, just in week or 2 weeks. So at the end of January, when the first killing started and representatives of official legal enforcement bodies, we don't still know who concrete killed Sennik, Knihayan, Zhizhnevsky. Yes. It was my psychological reach point. I told myself, it's always can be worse, and I have to be ready for everything which can happen. So since this time, because just in months, Russia started the war of aggression and occupied Crimea, part of Luhansk and Donetsk regions, I know that it can be worse.
Yes, and as you just said, this might not even be the big war. Well, I mean, from my perspective, when I was the editor of the Kyiv Post, I mean, we ran what seemed like hundreds of editorials, opinions, saying the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming. And it's horrible, the soldiers, that the scale of the killing that is happening now. Back then, it was of a smaller scale. I think we lost 14,000 soldiers in that eight-year period. So it was a small enough scale that we were able to humanize. We were able to get the pictures of the soldiers, their names, a little bit from the village and where they're from. That seems like, you know, almost an innocent time, even though it wasn't, because we had Slavonsk and Krematorsk and many other things. But it just seemed to me, and I go back to the archives, no, I mean, people were arguing against sanctions for Russia. People were continuing doing business. Of course, we had Angela Merkel, you know. And it just seemed to me historically that Russia was just waiting until Nord Stream 2 was completed before they moved on.
It was obvious.
And, you know, we still, you know, we're still not there to this point. Which brings to I mean, your career is already, you're very young, but your career is already many decades into, 2 decades at least into human rights law. We still don't have justice for the Heavenly Hundred. We still don't have justice for many murders. We still don't have justice for many, you know, crimes and corruption that we had suffered in Ukraine. We haven't delivered justice to ourselves in Ukraine, unfortunately. And I look at Pavel Lazarenko in the U.S., a great, you know, great court system, everything, 2 decades. And I think they're still appealing the seizure of, you know, the corrupt former prime minister, Pavel Lazarenko, assets. MH17, we're coming up to the 10th anniversary. We still don't have justice there. You're documenting tens of thousands of cases. I mean, is it that the justice where I would love to see, you know, a Nuremberg-type deal where Putin and his defense ministers and all his, you know, lieutenants are confronted with the evidence and sentenced to guilty. But it seems like the only justice that we're really going to get is journalists, historians, people like you documenting, I mean, human rights lawyers documenting and bringing these people's, the victim's stories to life. Or do you see there's still a path to...
I still think that we have it. And I look to this chance as our historical responsibility, because each generation have their own responsibility to move forward this international system of peace and security, and to make the new level of standards for justice for human rights abuses. Because before, it was said, but normal, that when you have wars or huge human rights crises, for example, like in Iran for current moment, it's sad, but it's obvious that majority of victims will have no chance for justice, because it's very difficult to individually track each story. But now we can challenge this norm, because we as a humankind are equipped, I mean technically. We have digital tools which provide us an opportunity to restore what happened, to document war crimes, to collect evidence, to identify perpetrators, to reach individually each human story, which we can't even dream during Balkans war just 30 years ago. So now we technically equipped. We have just to reach this ambitious goal, first to set this ambitious goal and start to move forward. And this is not just a chance, it's historical obligation.
We were just waiting for a forum, a tribunal with international enforcement powers.
Not just a tribunal, but tribunal is a very essential element. Let me remind why it's essential. Because when we have four types of international crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and crime against a crime of aggression, we have no international court which can prosecute this last type of crime, crime of aggression. But all these previous types of international crimes are committing because Putin and his surroundings started this war. And that's why it's like human logic. If we want to prevent wars in the future, we have to punish the states and their leaders who start such wars in present. And the problem is that in the whole history of humankind, we have no such a precedent, only one. It's Nuremberg and Tokyo's tribunal. Mm-hmm. All other tribunals like Rwanda, Yugoslavia, special courts in Sierra Leone, they persecuted people because they kill each other not according to the norms. If they killed each other according to the norms, there will be no tribunals. Mm-hmm. So we have to put the words beyond the legal frame. And that is why Ukraine officials and Ukraine civil society promoting the idea of creation a special court, like special tribunal on aggression, and to hold Putin and top political leadership and high military command of the Russian state accountable.
So you can see nations would have to like give up a bit of their sovereignty. So it would look something like this: to prevent wars, if an aggressor, like say, invades another country, then automatic sanctions would apply. They would be isolated and completely cut off from the world's economy. And if they committed human rights abuses, the same thing would apply. Nations would have to kind of surrender, agree that we will pursue justice against, but that would take military force, it would seem to me, to get Putin out of the Kremlin.
You're totally right. It needs another international architecture. Yeah. Because we have only one body whose official mandate is to use force when international obligations are violated. It's Security Council. And Russia has a veto power in Security Council, and that is why I like your brilliant beginning of our conversation, that Security Council gathering, they discussed this horrible attack to children hospitals and do nothing as usual because they can't do nothing.
They can't. Yeah, that's the World War II architecture. I would like to see, I mean, that obviously has to change, but, well, that's for greater minds like yours. And I think you're going to still stay with this, right? You're not going to switch to corporate law all of a sudden in 5 years.
But we can create a demand
for this.
For Ukrainians, it will be too late. But we are fighting for something which are not limited by national borders. Freedom, justice, human dignity, the value of human life. And that is why it's so important to support us in this fight, because even when we succeed for justice for Ukrainians, it will be a precedent for justice to other people in different parts of the globe who are suffering in this moment from wars and human rights violations.
And there's many of those.
Unfortunately. I will share with you two insights about justice, if I may.
Please.
I think it's very important, but not visible. I worked with people who went beyond the hell directly. And that's why I know that people see justice very differently. Not for all people, justice means to see their perpetrators behind the bars. For another people, justice means to get compensations. And without compensations, they will feel unsatisfied. For some people, justice means to know truth. Just to know truth, what happened with their beloved ones. And for some people, justice means to get an opportunity to be publicly heard and to get this official recognition that something which happened with them and their families is not just immoral, but illegal. And this means that our task is much more difficult, not just to investigate and prosecute perpetrators. We have to build comprehensive justice strategy with different elements to reach all these needs. To know truth, to give people opportunity to be heard, to get compensations, and to see their perpetrators behind the bars. And second thing, I traveled a lot. Now it's become a part of my job, because when we working on a new international mechanism of accountability, it means that you have to convince presidents, governments,
popes,
members of the parliaments, to do it, because it can't be just created in national frame. It's international level. And I understand that good people, they think that justice is important but secondary, because military support matters, peace matters, that negotiation matters. It can be different priorities, but not justice. What these people don't understand. They see justice only like a tool how to influence to the past and to the future. To the past, because you prosecute someone for something which have already been done.
Mm-hmm.
For the future, because it's a signal that if you will commit something the same, you will be prosecuted. But they don't understand that justice can change to reality today. Yeah. Because when Russians see themselves untouchable and suddenly they start to observe a real decisive legal actions, like the arrest warrant against Putin and his child commissioner Maria Lvova-Belova, like creation a special tribunal on aggression in the future, like other steps, even if part of Russians start to be doubted that probably this time they will not avoid responsibility, this doubt will be converted in cooling effect on brutality of human rights violations. And because we speak about ongoing large-scale war, it means that we can save thousands, thousands, and thousands of lives. This is impact of justice to present.
Okay, so that's a clear direction where you're going and your allies and the civilized world. But is there a plan to get these stories out there just so that in a systematized way? I mean, I know there's lots of books already about the war and everything, but it just seems to me that if nothing else, like you say, people need to know the names and what happened.
Created a national network of local documentators when the large-scale war started. Together with partners, we united dozens of regional organizations in this network, which is called Tribunal for Putin Initiative. And we jointly documented more than 75,000 episodes of international crimes. And now this is the biggest civil society database according to this war. And generally, this war is the most documented war in the human history. But we are doing this not just for national archives, which is important because even now Russia told that there is no Bucha massacre, that all these dead bodies was actors, that it was a false performance, etc., etc. Okay, it's very cynical, but you can imagine what Russia will say in dozens of years, and we have to have this solid evidence that it happened. We have respect to the work of historians and other purpose for which this evidence can be used, but we as a human rights lawyer are doing this for justice. Injustice can't be delayed for decades, because when justice is postponed, justice is denied.
How confident are you in the information you're getting from occupied Crimea, from occupied Donbas, from Ukrainian prisoners of war, from Ukrainian children taken to Russia? Is your network good, or is it just hard to get information now about what's going on?
For sure, we can't record each criminal episode which is going on in occupied territories, especially because when we speak about gray zone where people have no tools how to defend their rights, their freedom, their property, their lives, and their beloved ones, it's a territory of fear and a territory of Lord helplessness. Because when you're faced with unprecedented cruelty, in order to survive mentally, you start to change your mind. You start to tell yourself, I can do nothing with it. I just want to survive, and in order to survive, if they want me to speak Russian language, I will speak Russian language. If they want me to get my children to the election of Russian militaries, I will let them go. I just want to survive, and this is psychological effect of terror which Russian imposed in occupied territories. And in such conditions, as long as the territory is under occupation, means less information you get from there. Mm-hmm. Because when violence become a norma, people start to avoid to notice this violence.
Yes, it's helplessness, and there's a human tendency to take the path of least resistance, especially if you don't feel like you can change anything. Is that really possible, living next to Russia and everything that we've seen, especially in the last few years? And my question to you is, we can't really control, we can influence the West, but we can't control what they do. We certainly can't control what Russia does, although we can try to punish them in the ways that we can and get our allies to have sanctions. But it seems to me that Ukrainian society is going to have to be to reorganize itself for endless war. And that means more soldiers starting at age 18, equipping them and training them because they are a part of a civil society, part of a democracy, so that they are confident that they're going to go to war and survive it, like many American soldiers. Is Ukrainian society, and the other thing is we've lost 6 million people, including 1 million people abroad. Is Ukrainian society ready for, we can fight, but we're not really, I'm an American living here. Ukrainians are generally a peaceful country who are not going to invade anybody or harm anybody else. But it seems to me we have to get ready for forever war, like Israel.
Russia is preparing for a long-lasting war. It's obvious when you see how Russia changed their type of economy, about this mobilization and militarization of Russian society, the emergence of new middle class, which is Russian military and their relatives, how they viewed the war as a tool how to return breath to depressive regions with the creation of new military factories and plants. So it's become profitable. The war, long-lasting war, unfortunately, become profitable for Russian society. And it will be very naive to think that it will be war just with Ukraine. Sorry. you like listen what Russian officials and Russian propagandists speak publicly. They declare the war to the West values. This is not just a war with Ukraine. It's not the war between two states. This is a war between two systems. So don't be naive that it will stop in Ukraine. If it will not be able to stop Putin in Ukraine, he will go further. And in such circumstances, when we speak about long-lasting war, it's very important to ask the question in a proper way, because the answer will be different. It's not a question how Ukraine will survive and change in order to be neighbor with a country which is want to conduct the long-lasting war. The question is how, okay, at least Europe, especially European Union and allies of European Union, will survive, and when they have a 140 million country with nuclear weapon and veto power in UN, which wanted to conduct long-lasting war, and which see European Union as a field of Russian interests. So this is a question. Because when someone asks me, you are Ukrainian, so what are your plan? It's a wrong question to ask.
You ask them what their plan is.
Yes. It's just true. Ukrainian problem.
But we are, unfortunately, the people in Ukraine and the Ukrainian soldiers especially, I'm sitting here safely because of Ukrainian soldiers. Can we do it, though? Can we become a warrior society, big Israel, understand the fact that much of our economy, rather than, as you mentioned, spending our money on education or roads or culture, we're going to have to be a society that has the best weapons, the best fighters, and we're never going to get away from that.
It means that we have to have a long-term strategy. A short-term strategy is visible, help Ukraine to win, because it stopped Russia. It stopped Russia, as it provides at least a chance for some changes in Russia itself, because Russian people, they can't tolerate war criminal as a president, but they will not tolerate loser war criminal as a president. So there is no guarantee, but to have a chance is still
luxury. You're of the school that says they need to be defeated to have a chance of Russian democracy. Because I know you work with Russian human rights.
But yes, on everyday basis, we have thousands of illegally detained Ukrainians. And for us, the only way how to sometimes save their lives with a very small steps, just to send medicine, it's only possible through our Russian human rights colleagues. And that's why the head of the Human Rights Center Memorial, with whom we share the Nobel Peace Prize, was jailed just several months ago.
Oleg Orlov. I wanted to ask you about that. You, of the co-winners, I mean, you're the freest. Oleg Orlov, are you in touch? It seems to me he got a multi-year prison sentence.
Oh, the last time when I was in touch with him, it was before this final court hearing where the verdict was announced. And then I get information, as anyone else, from his lawyers. And I'm the only head of human rights organization who received Nobel Peace Prize in 2022 who still free.
That's
all of other co-recipients are in jail, and this means that I have to work in three times harder.
Man,
also for them.
And we're talking the third one is Aless Pilatsky.
Yes,
did I pronounce him right?
Yes, he was jailed on the moment when the Nobel Peace Prize was announced, and this is his second term. Interesting to mention that I was in Minsk. In the court hearing when he was jailed first time. I came here as a gesture of solidarity. We all know that no way, it's fabricated criminal case and he will be jailed. But I was there this time. It was possible for me to be there to show this human solidarity, which also important, and we can't underestimate it. So return to your question. Right. We need a long-term strategy towards Russia. And we, I mean international community, which declare and real practice democratic values, still don't have it. And this is a problem. This is a problem. Because if we don't know what we will want in the end, always will play someone else's game. Because Russia know what they want. Russia always proactive. Russia commits something horrible, then presented it like fait accompli, like a new normality, how Peskov said, and then push international community to reckon with it.
Exactly.
We have no long-term strategy. What we want to do with Russia? We can't say that it's a blind spot. It's not a blind spot. It's a huge country with 140 million people, with a veto power in UN, with nuclear weapons, and with imperialistic ambition, and with a very special mindset to see what a human being is. Because you're totally right. They don't see value of life of children in hospital in Ukraine, but even worse, the human life generally is the cheapest resource in Russia.
They're proving that day in and day out. But the strategy has to come from Ukraine, within Ukraine.
Yes, so we have to be a part of group who developed the strategy, but I don't see any attempt to develop it. It's always reaction.
It's inside Ukraine.
No.
Inside the West.
It's always reaction.
Well, that's true. I mean, but that goes back to, you know, people don't get excited or they, you know, overcoming indifference, because people just don't until it hits them.
Because they still don't want to take responsibility. It's a crisis of responsibility. The politicians in the West live in illusion that probably this problem will vanish, or at least it will be not their problem in 5 years.
Well, true. We have that short-term thing. That's the West. And I agree with you. That there isn't. I'm in that camp that says, you know, we need a strategy to win because the West plus Ukraine is much stronger than Russia plus China plus Iran plus North Korea. But do we have that in Ukraine? Because human nature, you know, everybody longs for the day where we don't have a war. But I'm starting to tell people, I don't think there's that day. It's not going to come where we're going to have the victory parade. I mean, we're going to, you know, I just think it's going to be, I think Ukraine is obviously proved it's going to be an independent nation forever. But I just think that we're going to be a warrior nation. I don't know. I hope I'm wrong.
We have to start a real public discussion of what victory means for us. Because imagine even this fantastic scenario that tomorrow we will return all Ukrainian territories.
That would be sweet.
But it doesn't mean that the day after tomorrow, Russia will not start the war again. It also means do this picture of victory ingrain the picture of Ukraine which succeed in democratic transition? Or just military aspect of the victory? What victory means for us? So it have different layers. It can have different scenarios and can have different chronological internal intermediate goals.
Mm. Yes.
And I think that we have to be very pragmatic to understand that we can reach everything not just in one moment. So it's pass, it's a way, and we have to go forward on this way to succeed these intermediate goals and go further and further and further.
That's going to be stamina and strength, because Putin, not just killing people, he's managed to terrorize millions into leaving the country.
Oh, yes.
And our birth rate is the lowest it's ever been since independence.
Yes, because it's a human nature. When you see how they sent rocket deliberately to hit hospital where children were treated for cancer, you can tell yourself, oh my God, I can't stand with it. Let's do everything just to stop it. But the problem is that Putin will not stop. He will do the same horror in another way. And I documented this horror for 10 years in occupied territories. Before large-scale war started, the world closed their eyes what's going on in these occupied territories. Occupation, what I understand for myself, it's another form of the war. Occupation don't decrease human suffering. Occupation makes this human suffering invisible.
Would the world be more peaceful if women were in charge and we had more equal rights, or not necessarily?
Let's at least try.
Okay. Well, we've tried with the old white men.
Men failed. Yes. Let's be honest. So let's at least try.
I would like to see, because that's democracy's great strength, is if we have equal rights. You are from Bayarka.
I was born in Kiev.
Oh, you were.
But I spent my childhood in Bayarka. That's why Bayarka is my native city, because I grew up there.
There's actually a lot of famous people from there.
Different
composers,
people.
Composers, artists, Max Levin, Eugene Hoots, other people. Something in the water there that makes people excel, or just...
Oh, but we have an enormous amount of fantastic people from different small cities and villages in Ukraine. So it's not just one example. Like, it's a human nature. When you face with dramatic times, some people start to express their best features.
Yes. Well, I certainly think that you're one of them. And we've had a nation full of people, of heroes, actually, in the last tested. And if this isn't the big war, I don't want to see the big war, but I fear you're right. But was there a sense, I'm sure you watched NATO, you watched the reaction to the hospital bombings. West is moving, but still not fast enough and still doesn't get it. Or is there an aha moment where they've said, it's going to work, we're going to do this?
On the language of dictators, the West show weakness.
Still.
And that's why the dictators will attack again.
Okay. Well, there's a whole lot more I would love to talk to you about. But I think now is a good time to leave it, unless there's something else you want to go over.
Yes, I want to emphasize once again that, yes, we in Ukraine are preparing for a very difficult future in nearest months. You know that the energy infrastructure is ruined. We don't know how to survive the winter. We have a lack of air defense system and rockets. And with this weak response to heat of children hospitals, it's very easy to predict that very soon it will repeat it, such behavior. But still, despite this everything, the story of Ukraine is life-affirming story. Because Ukrainian people show that the readiness to fight for freedom and prove this readiness not just by words and pathetic statements, but on the battlefield. They prove it also near this children's hospitals when it happened. Hundreds of people start to do something to help each other and to collect money for hospital, to bring water, to restore rubbles. And like, it shows me once again that when someone tried to take your freedom, the freedom can powerfully speak up through the concrete individuals. Mm-hmm. And this will be remembering in the world history. That's why this is a life-affirming story.
Well put, as always, Alexander Matveychuk. You know, I always wanted to ask you this as well. I mean, everybody has to take a break mentally from the horror that we live in. Well, I'm not a soldier at the front. That's real danger, but just living in Ukraine brings its own set of stress. Do you take a break? How do you do that?
I'm not a good example.
Not a good example.
I'm not a good example. I don't tell that break is something useless. And I don't pretend that I don't need a break. But still, while I can keep moving forward, I will do. I just understand pragmatically that this is a long-lasting marathon, and if I can't allow myself to have a break, at least I have to do everything to keep my energy and to keep my strength, and to find not a so-called life-work balance, but war-life balance.
War-life balance.
Something like this.
Well, at least in marathons, we know real marathons, you know that how far you have to run, 26 miles. Here we don't. But I'm glad that you decided to come in and spend your valuable time talking with us at Hromadske Radio.
It's me who very grateful for invitation.
You are one of Ukraine's great treasures, and I know you are not a one-person show. You have a team, and you have many allies, but you have been really giving voice to human rights and beyond that, you know, trying to think of ways, and we all have to do that in the world, and we haven't arrived there, to prevent wars and to punish war criminals so that we can actually achieve universal declaration of human rights. And for that, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's Ukraine Calling. Powerful episode, and I thank all the listeners. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on the Hromadske Radio website, and you can find us wherever you get your podcast. Please join us again for the next episode.
Ukraine Calling.